thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace, streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount I'm fixed upon it, mount of God's redeeming God. Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I run, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus saw me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God. He too rescued me from danger, interposed his precious blood. Oh, to grace how great a debtor, daily I'm constrained to thee. Let thy heaven like a fetter bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Sing, here's my heart. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. You may be seated. The faith, and Leslie is going to preach this morning. So thank you, Leslie, for bringing the word.
Oh, I love seeing all your faces. My name is Leslie. I'm one of your newer pastors here at Santa Barbara Community Church. I am very, very happy to be with you all this morning. As James said, today we are continuing our series on famous hymns of the church, and we're going to be learning about my absolute favorite hymn, Come Thou Fount, which we just sang. I don't think that I am alone in loving this hymn because it's been modernized by everyone from Jars of Clay to Fernando Ortega, Chris Tomlin to Marcus Mumford, one of my favorites, and even for our junior hires and their very equally cool middle-aged parents, hip-hop artist Forrest Frank. Along with studying this hymn, I'd like to study a passage of Scripture. And so with that, I would love for you to stand up for the reading of God's Word. We are going to be reading out of Mark 9, 14 through 29. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him. And when the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into convulsion. He fell to the ground. He rolled around, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And the spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. And the boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand, and he lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. And after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, "Why couldn't we drive him out?" He replied, "This kind can come out only by prayer." The word of the Lord. I'm one of those people who loves music, all kinds of artists, all kinds of genres. But just because one loves music does not mean that one has a good singing voice. So for a lot of us, singing is one of the most vulnerable things that we could ever think of doing. It's embarrassing. I won't say that my voice is terrible. I was going to say it was terrible, but I'm going to say more it's untrained, and I've never learned how to use it. So I spent most of my younger years singing really softly or mouthing the words, even in this room. When one of our sons was a baby, he didn't sleep well, like at all. And he was up many times every night, and no matter what I tried, he wouldn't stay asleep, and he wouldn't go back to sleep when he woke up. And as you can imagine, for any of you parents out there, you know, I became very sleep-deprived and honestly kind of the worst version of myself, pretty angry that nothing I was doing worked. But I knew the first couple verses of Come Thou Fount. It was the only hymn that I knew a little bit, and for whatever reason, that was the hymn that came to mind. Somewhere deep down, I knew that my baby didn't need soothing as much as I needed to surrender. So I began to sing aloud to calm myself before I could even try to calm my son. And soon it became a nightly rhythm in the 2 a.m. and the 4 a.m. hours, and it's still a rhythm at our house today. But of course, this hymn wasn't meant to be a lullaby. It was actually written by a 22-year-old British preacher, Robert Robinson, in 1758 to accompany his Pentecost Sunday sermon, which is interesting because I would argue that this sermon is less about Pentecost and more about faith and doubt. So a little bit of background. Before coming to faith, Robert Robinson was fatherless. He was living away from home as a barber's apprentice in London when he fell into the wrong crowd. It was kind of a gang of sorts. And one Sunday, at 17 years old, he and his friends tried to get an old fortune teller drunk. They were intending to make a sport of her tales, but the woman's prophecy that he would see his children and his great-grandchildren gave him pause. "Is my reckless life what I want for my children?" And the story goes that later that day, Robinson took the gang of friends to a revival service where a well-known preacher at the time, George Whitefield, was speaking on the wrath of God, which was a common revival message at that time. And it made Robinson rethink his life and how he was living it. His notebook said that he found God that night, but it was 3 more years before he felt inner peace and joy in his salvation. Now, for a little opinion from me, while I think some experience a specific moment when we decide to put our faith in Christ, I think it's equally common, perhaps even more common, that we come to faith over time. For some, we make a head decision, and it takes a little while for our hearts to catch up. I can't help but wonder if Robinson's initial coming to faith was more out of fear than anything else. And I also wonder how this fear may have impacted his beliefs, at least his initial ones about God's character. But we're going to push more into that in a minute. So at only 22 years old, he pins this hymn. And after, Robinson's spiritual path took many turns. He moved between denominations. He served as a Methodist preacher. Then he worked with independents before settling for nearly 30 years as a Baptist pastor. And this bouncing around between faith traditions is actually really fairly common today, but I wonder how it was perceived back then, and certainly how his theological evolution was understood or not understood by those he shepherded. And here's something that we always wince about when it comes to faithful leaders. Robinson's faith also wavered quite a bit, and he grappled with periods of instability and doubt. There's a story, it's unverified, but powerful nonetheless, of an older Robert Robinson riding in a stagecoach and overhearing a young woman humming his favorite famous hymn. And he heard it, his eyes filled with tears, and he said, "Madame, I am the poor, unhappy man who wrote that hymn many years ago, and I would give 1,000 worlds, if I had them, to enjoy the feelings I had then." Oof, right? The easiest stories to tell are those of heroes of the faith, people we can be inspired by, perhaps emulate. What do you do with stories of faith-filled people who change their minds? In Alan and Deborah Hirsch's book, Untamed, they write, "People leave their faith for reasons such as spiritual shallowness, status anxiety, pursuit of wealth, fear of persecution, or because of many others, sometimes even demonic anti-discipleship forces that are at work in our world. But my observation is this. Often, to build on David Stoker's word for us last week, people leave faith because of a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad diagnosis or loss. Suffering tries our faith. It has tried mine. And when people leave their faith, it's not typically because they all of a sudden don't believe God exists anymore. It's because they believe God does exist and he's uncaring and not trustworthy and detached. Maybe you're sitting here today going through the motions because you've been privately and secretly wrestling with whether you can trust Christ because he's let you down. Or maybe this church or the American church at large has let you down, and you've confused other people's sins and behaviors with the true heart of the Father's love for you. You're going through the motions, but there's no feeling left. I want you to know that your doubt in God's power and his goodness is normal, but it cannot be dealt with in secret. So this morning, I'm going to give you 4 charges from this hymn that can help when you or someone you love is wrestling with this kind of doubt, and I'm going to do it while looking at the story of the demon-possessed boy, okay? Here's the first place we're going to camp for a bit. We are acknowledging that faith is a gift, but beliefs must be worked out. So Robert Robinson opens this hymn in the very first few lines singing, "Come thou fount of every blessing, come Jesus, tune my heart to sing thy grace." And he's saying, only you, your grace, can ready my heart to receive the gift of faith. A major tenet of our theology as believers comes from Ephesians 2:8-9. You all probably know it, where it affirms, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not from yourselves, it's a gift from God, not by works, so that no one can boast." But our beliefs about God's character, believing in his mercy, his goodness, his desire to connect with us as father to child, do require work on our end. It is work we do with Jesus' help, but work nonetheless. And it's a work that I speculate Robert Robinson was doing throughout his life, but particularly in those 3 years when he first came to accept Jesus as his Lord and Savior and when he found true peace. Faith is a gift, but what we believe about God is a lifetime's work. And it's often impacted by trauma, struggle, pain, hardship, both in what happens to us and what we see happen to other people, including terrible behavior committed by Christians. For many, then, a crisis of faith occurs. Although I would argue it's less a crisis of faith and more a crisis of beliefs. A more concise and popular cultural term is deconstruction. The act of deconstruction has been around a lot longer than Robert Robinson's writing of Come Thou Fount, but the word itself has been more commonly used in recent years. And in the Christian context, at its worst, Deconstruction means burning everything down that someone believes about their faith and starting over. For some, at the end of deconstruction, there's no faith left at all. But at its best, when someone examines and questions and reevaluates why they believe what they believe, then it's possible to reconstruct. And often in that reconstruction, a person realizes that they're not questioning their faith so much as their beliefs about God's character and his love for them and his ability to forgive and to heal. Through reconstruction, belief becomes deeper than before. Pastor and writer A.J. Swoboda, in his book titled After Doubt, calls this the theological journey. And he writes, the theological journey is our lifetime process of refining and ironing out our beliefs about God. Why? Because even our thinking demands sanctification. None of us comes fully equipped with a perfectly developed, nuanced, articulated vision of God. The process of forming right beliefs takes time. It is messy, often embarrassing, and demands humility, passion, and perseverance. I have a set of images to show you from the Theodicy organization. It gives a little bit more of a visual for the theological journey. And here we expand this idea of belonging as either in or out. Of course, when it comes to believing that Jesus is the Son of God, sent to forgive the sins of the world so that we may have union with God, it's either a yes or a no. I'm not suggesting we abandon the doctrines of our faith. The problem is we can get stuck here, both in the way we view our relationship with God or others' relationships with God. Once in relationship with Christ, to me, it's more helpful to notice, am I moving towards Jesus or am I moving away from him? I think this image reminds us that the theological journey could also just be called discipleship, where all of us are being formed and responding to the Spirit at work in our lives. And at times we may question, but we are still in the loving embrace of God. Now let's go back to the gospel story that we just read a few minutes ago in Mark, the story of the demon-possessed boy. I think it's one of the best examples of reconstruction in the Bible. Here we have a desperate father who brings his son before Jesus, the boy who has long been possessed by an evil spirit in such a way that he cannot talk. He's often thrown to the ground, rolling around, convulsing, foaming at the mouth. It's a whole scene. And his father, despite asking for healing for a long, long time, has never received it. And in this moment, the father is still not receiving healing for his child. The disciples have tried and they have failed. N.T. Wright says, in the first half of the gospel, many people come to Jesus with what appears comparatively easy faith. They touch him and they're healed. And it seems as simple as that. But for this man in this situation, faith is hard. I have to imagine the disciples' failure to heal only contributed to more doubt for the father. The father's brain is battling right now, right? He's thinking, of course they can heal everyone but my son. Have you ever felt this way? Because I have. Because in this life, we all have moments of disappointment in God, and some of us more than others. Some of us have asked God for miracles that went unanswered. Some of us have experienced deep betrayal by people who are community trusted. Some of us have been waiting for healing for a very, very long time, or waiting for a child for a very, very long time, waiting to get married for a very, very long time. Some have received answers, but they're not the answers that we wanted. And all along, we're talking to God about these things, and we're asking people to pray for us, and they are, because our faith in his existence can be so solid, but our belief in his good character and his even greater capabilities can, at the same time, be really small. Personally, I can tell you that when a person is healed from something, some kind of disease, they've usually first been brought close to death. And when they're at their weakest, before you know if they will survive, it can be hard not to question if God is present. James Edwards writes, "True faith is always aware how small and inadequate it is. The father becomes a believer not when he amasses a sufficient quantum of faith, but when he risks everything on what little faith he has, when he yields his insufficiency to the true sufficiency of Christ, crying out, 'Lord, I do believe. Help my unbelief.'" So is this a confession of doubt or a confession of faith? I don't think it's either. It's simply a father reaching out his hand for God in humility, longing for help, desiring connection with his maker, even though he's been disappointed in the past. He's remaining open to God. When things don't make sense, when we're looking around for God and we're not finding him in that present moment, we often have to look to the past so that we can trust him for the future. And that brings us to our second movement, which is counting the ways God shows up and remembering what he's done. So in the second stanza of Robinson's hymn, we sing, "Here I raise my Ebenezer, hitherto thy help I'm come." What is an Ebenezer? Because I will tell you, it's not referring to the main character of A Christmas Carol. The word Ebenezer comes from 1 Samuel 7:12, when Samuel erects a stone monument to commemorate God's supernatural help in defeating the Philistines. This is a combination of two Hebrew words that together are translated to stone of help. So when Robinson writes, "Here I raise my Ebenezer," he's essentially saying, "I'm acknowledging the ways you've provided for me and cared for me and helped me." I know a common practice for some families, ours did this for quite some time, is actually collecting rocks and using a marker to write the ways that God has helped our family on those rocks. And this is not a counting our blessings exercise so much as counting our rescues. And now looking back at the story of the demon-possessed boy, let's tackle another few lines that often feel perplexing. The verses where Jesus says to the crowds, "You unbelieving generation, how long must I stay with you? How long do I have to put up with you? Bring the boy to me." Commentators say here that the word generation refers to the people living at that time, while also echoing the language used in the Old Testament to describe the Israelites' frequent unbelief and rebellion and God's long-standing patience for them. So I think this is Jesus creating his own Ebenezer of sorts. He's asking, "Don't you remember the ways that God has been patient and rescued you, O Israel? If you did, why would you doubt me now?" And yet, because we are human, and because the world is full of pain, and because God doesn't always answer the way we want, we do doubt. So we have to confess the proneness to wander. I love this line in Robinson's third stanza. "Let that grace now, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love." It's just so darn honest, right? Yet churches are not always safe places to wrestle. In fact, at one point in Nazarene hymnals, the words in this song were changed. They were changed from "prone to wander" to read, "Let me know thee in thy fullness," showing just how uncomfortable, historically, the church can be about doubt. I think the wandering words are why this hymn has become so well-loved generation after generation, because we need to hear other people saying what we've experienced. Sometimes we need permission to say aloud, to confess what's going on in our minds and hearts, to take away some of the power. And I wonder what it would be like if we sang things like, "Prone to lie, Lord, I feel it. Prone to cheat, Lord, I feel it. Prone to worship money, Lord, I feel it." And yet, prone to wander, even the word wander, is such an intentional but spot-on choice of words, because we don't typically run away from God as much as we walk away quietly with guilt, slowly, 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 until it feels too far to come back. And of course, reading this line in light of knowing Robinson's later wandering is even more humbling, because remember, he wrote this hymn at 22 years old when he was still fairly new in his faith. How wise that even then, in those early passionate years, he still saw his tendency to doubt, so he begged God. And then we're going to talk about the word fetter. Essentially, the word fetter means to chain or shackle someone by their feet, so he's asking God to chain us so tightly that we can never escape or resist the free offer of grace. Chain me to you, God, because I will wander away. Knowing how strong the tendency is to walk away, to do life by our own control, is why our initial faith conversion, that first moment when we ask God to invade our lives, cannot be a one-time only moment. Robinson's lyrics invite us to surrender and submit again and again and again. In the last lines of this hymn, we sing, "Here's my heart, O take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above." Originally, the words were a little bit different, and they read, "Take my heart, Lord, take and feel it," F-E-A-L, "seal it for thy courts above." There's a few different ways to interpret the word "feel," which isn't commonly used anymore, and I tend to believe that Robinson's intention here, because it's used as a verb, is rooted in the Old English word "fiolin," which means to enter or pass into, as in, "Take my heart, Lord, take and enter into it." And then "seal" is a Latin word. It's probably connected to the Old English word insigne, like the little stamp that would have someone's initials engraved on it. You would melt wax, put it on an envelope, and then seal it with your initials. So he's saying, enter into my life, my heart, and then mark me as your own. If these words feel familiar, it's because I think the evangelical tradition tends to use similar language when we invite people to ask Jesus into their hearts for the first time. I mentioned this at the beginning. I said I would come back to it. Robert Robinson spent 3 years wrestling with his salvation at the beginning of his faith journey, and he'd spend the latter years doing the same. That moment of asking God to enter your life, for some it changes everything. And for others, it's just one mark on the theological journey. A wedding day marks a legally defining moment between two people, but a marriage with all its sorrows and joys and pain and growth is what truly defines a union. So when I say surrender and submit again and again and again, I mean that our lives will have moments where we question God's goodness and power and presence, just like Robinson. And anyone who has walked through suffering knows what I mean here. When you cry out to God for answers, from release, from chronic pain, for healing, from disease, and God doesn't reply the way you want, or he's silent, these are potential turning point moments on that theological journey. The boy with the unclean spirit is a turning point moment for the disciples. Until this point in their discipleship journey, they had been able to heal. And now all of a sudden, it's not working. Why, they ask? Why couldn't we cast out that evil spirit? We didn't see them walking away from their faith, right? But we do see them holding new questions. They're still learning. Their power is not their own. Their power is rooted in surrender to God's power. And here we also see the father of this demon-possessed boy still surrendering. He has surrendered his son over to the disciples, and they couldn't do anything, but he's not giving up. He's weary, and he's questioning, and he has little faith left that God can heal, but he still surrenders his son. And then Jesus rebukes the unclean spirit. The boy convulses violently and falls to the ground like a corpse. It's a whole scene, right? We don't know how long he laid there. Seconds? Minutes? Either way, pretend it is your own child or a child that you love in your life. If you've waited and you've prayed and you've been disappointed for many, many years, and then that child falls to the ground and appears to be dead, what then? About this gospel moment, James Edwards says, "Salvation is a process in which things sometimes become worse before they become better. The first test of the Father's faith is to trust the word and promise of Jesus alone, not the immediate empirical consequences of it." I want to be really clear that I don't believe that Jesus is testing the Father or his Son in this scene. We live in a broken world. The Father is being tested by a world that's not as it should be. He is living in the between of earth and eternity. We all are. Can we trust the word and promise of Jesus alone during this between time? Something that we don't know much about but feels like a crucial part to Robert Robinson's story is that he lost his daughter, Julia, when she was only 17 years old. And we don't know if this was sudden or if it was after an illness, but we do know it was a severe blow to Robinson, and very likely, as it would be for all of us, a contributing factor to his wandering years. When our son, the baby I sang to, was very ill, I sang this hymn as soon as I saw him after surgery. For me, worship became an act of submission when I was questioning God's goodness. And since that time, I've become someone who is not ashamed to sing out loud or raise my hands both in praise but also in surrender. I sang this song as our baby slept, as our son slept, but it has never put me to sleep. It's actually kept me awake. It's been a comfort to me in times of trouble, a reminder of my theology when I needed it most. And perhaps it was the same for Robert Robinson, who was preaching to himself from the very beginning. Towards the end of his life, Robinson formed close friendships with Unitarians, leading some to question whether he strayed from Orthodox Christianity. But on the day he died, he'd preached two times that Sunday. His heart may have been weary and questioning, but I like to think that at the very end, he was saying, "I do believe, Lord, help my unbelief." There's space in this story for a wide variety of experiences that are likely represented in this room. And so I want to ask, where do you see yourself in Mark 9? What does this bring to mind for you in your own life? Are you the father coming to Jesus with deep unmet needs or answers? Have you been the young boy unable to speak at all, but trusting that someone else is crying out on your behalf? Maybe you identify with the disciples who are standing to the side, watching Jesus do only what Jesus can do, and you're not sure how to enter into the stories of the suffering. Not everyone in this room is struggling with their beliefs about God, but if you are, I would beg you to do it in the company of others. Deconstruction is, like I said earlier, not a bad thing, but when you reconstruct, it's hard to do on your own. So seek out a pastor here or a trusted friend in your home group. We would love to offer you some resources and a listening ear. Mark's gospel also shows how much time Jesus spent with the Father and the Son trying to understand their pain. Here we see a God who's not just providing a quick fix, but a heart connection. He's not anxious or rattled by the Father's doubt. So if someone in your life is wrestling with their theology, I would encourage you first to start with a listening posture, an enormous amount of patience, and a heart connection. Because often people's doubts are rooted in deep, deep pain. Can we be people who are professionals at meeting others in their pain, just like Jesus did? I'm going to invite you up here soon to the communion table. And while you kind of process communion, I'm going to leave these questions up on the screen to think about and talk to God about. The story of redemption tells us that God's loved us so much that to save us from our own rebellion, he sent his son to willingly die on a cross and pay the penalty of our sin. It is that willing sacrifice that we remember week by week as we come to the table. We take bread and we remember Jesus' body pierced in surrender to the will of the Father. And we dip it in the wine and we remember Jesus' blood shed in surrender to the will of the Father. And as we remember Christ's sacrifice, we offer our whole lives again in surrender to the will of our Father, who, even in our pain and even in our wrestling, is so near. There are going to be prayer teams, as there always are, on both sides of the stage and in the back. And if you're feeling any kind of tug on your heart today for you or for someone that you love, I would really encourage you and invite you to come up and share whatever needs you have today.